In the UK MOD, we have an awful lot of simulators, but we have very few war games. There's a slight modification to that when we get to the end, but why do we have simulations? And the primary answer is to save money. There are other reasons. Yes, it's to test capabilities that we can't test in peacetime, normally. So, for example, a multi-barrel rocket launcher strike on the centre of a city is not something you tend to do live. If you want to do convoy training, I'm not sure that there'd be the political will to allow you to send 30-ton vehicles through the centre of London with escorts and heavy machine guns, although it might be fun. So I'm going to do a quick run through of the simulators that we have. And the simulators are there to save money. At the SDSR, we went through and tried to work out how much we spend on training, because we hadn't really sat down and categorized it. So given the 7 billion that we spend on training, how much of that do we spend and where? And if you look at the equipment running cost, the yellow bit, that's a significant chunk. So if we can reduce the running costs, that would help. Now, those of you who are in the military, of course, we get cuts on our training budget. And usually, that's in the travel and subsistence. So, utter pointless waste of time at saving money up there, when that's the bit we want to start saving money on. Okay. So, this is what we use simulations for. Training. A little bit on decision support, mainly with the assistance of the SDL. And there's what we do in the margins. There's a little bit of stuff that's specifically for education. So that's roughly, you know, the proportions. So first of all, because I'm in the land environment, I'll start with the land. Command and staff training. So this is simulated troops, simulated equipment, constructive simulation. We have icons on a map. This simulation has line of sight. It's one of the first ones that did. It was designed 20 years ago, and it even had line of sight then, which is quite rare in a constructive sim. So the icons have properties, they move around the map, and they engage each other according to a set of rules in the computer. It will run from the battle group to the core level. And this is an exercise that I designed when I was on the staff of Headquarters ARC, exercise Arcade Fusion. So that's a 1,000-man exercise control, 9,000 participants in 4 countries. I don't think we'll be seeing many of those in the next couple of years. And the random old bloke I've got up there is General Jackson. He was commander at the ARC at the time, and he is actually on the Abacus Master Control screen. My corporal rushed up to me and said, "Sir, sir, the general's on the computer," with much angst in his voice, to which my response was, "Well, it is his train set. He can do what he wants." What I didn't reveal to him, and perhaps I should, is that the general had come round about 4 hours earlier and said, "What's going on? Can you show me?" So I said, "Yes." Called up the screen, and it's just a mass of icons. And I said, "Right, we'll turn off all the icons, and we've got the routes." And I thought this might come up, so I've assigned routes by division. So if we turn on the routes, we can see that one UK armoured div is moving like this, and the enemy is moving like this. So they might miss each other. I said, "It's worse than that, General, because if we put the icons back on, and we look at some of the icons, we can see that the enemy are moving on average 30 kilometres an hour. And the friendly forces are moving on average 20 kilometres an hour." The general got his notebook out and made a few notes. He then came back some hours later and did it all himself. Now, the interface for the computer system is mind-bogglingly complex. And if the core commander can grasp that in a few minutes and get on the computer and use it himself, I think that's quite a powerful message for people who are learning about the utility of computer simulations and also the brain power of the core commander himself. So that was quite a lesson for me. So that's command and staff training. We have it in three locations. It cost $17 million to buy, including the buildings, and it takes £25,000 a week to train a battle group headquarters of about 60 guys with about 60 lower controllers. Okay? If you want a new piece of equipment, it's a parametric database. You just get it out of James, you type it in, and the staff that are there will do it for you. So it costs nothing to change your ORBAT. It costs nothing to create a new terrain database because GEO will provide the geographic organisation will provide the data. It takes 2 or 3 months, maybe 3 or 4 months, to generate the database and test it. But it's a very efficient system and it's very cheap. So we can go to the next stage, which is the Combined Arms Tactical Trainer, or in the States, CCTT. And the roughly equivalent. What it is you have the players in these boxes. The little box at the front is where the driver sits, the box there is where the crew sits. It's a medium fidelity training. Some people say it's high fidelity, but I've seen the Dutch kit and it's way higher than our fidelity, so it's a medium fidelity training. When those guys in that box look out of the vision blocks and sensors inside the vehicle, they look onto a shared 3D virtual environment that looks a little bit like 1990s computer game graphics. So that's about 100 vehicles represented, 400 or 500 crew, maybe up to 1,000, all looking at a shared terrain database in a building. We have two of those. They operate in the UK and Germany. Now, we are the only people in the world that operate these at battle group level. The Americans are far more sensible. They have hundreds of them at company level. We just wanted to be bigger. Yeah. Quite a lot of money to create. The one in Germany uses so much electricity we had to build a power station, which is great. It was absolutely genius because when we're not using it, we sell the power to the local German economy. But it's quite expensive. To run it is £250,000 a week. To train a battle group headquarters in the same way as we train them in CAST. The difference is, instead of having 50 lower controllers on a computer screen pretending to be your subordinates, you've got all your subordinates taking part. So the quality of the output is much better. But it is 10 times more expensive. And if you want a new vehicle, it'll probably cost you £1 million to do the code. That's just the code. If that vehicle needs a high-fidelity simulator, depending on how many you've got in the battle group, another £10 or £20 million. So, not insignificant cost. And then, of course, if you want a new terrain database, well, the one of Afghanistan took 3 years and about to acquire. So, yep, it's a better quality. Is it 10 times better quality? At 10 times the price. Next, we have TES, Tactical Engagement System, which is laser tag on steroids, as Matt said. I would say it's laser tag for grown-ups, but I wouldn't. Real troops, real equipment with simulated effects. So here we have the tank, here we see the laser transmitter and some of the receivers, and then we've even got stuff on the individuals, on the soldiers. Because we're using real troops, this is slightly more expensive. It's about £2 million for a week to train a battle group headquarters. So actually it's roughly 10 times as expensive as CAT. But of course, live training is the best training you can have. Because of course, if it isn't raining, it isn't training. Real men love the smell of diesel in the morning. And you know, it's absolutely fantastic. Unless it's raining. Because the laser doesn't work terribly well in the rain. And unless you're standing behind a bush, because the laser doesn't go through a bush. And if you're firing at buildings, of course, that doesn't work either, and we haven't actually got a system that will blow up the building in a way. And although we have the artillery system that will very accurately work out where you are, you don't get the whiz-bang noise. So a guy's got to drive up in a Land Rover and throw some thunder flashes out in the good old-fashioned way. But other than that, of course, it is the most realistic training you'll ever get. Although it's not the most efficient training, because of course, in order to get all this kit out onto the field, you have to parade at 6 o'clock in the morning, sign your weapon out from the armory, check that it's safe, and issue the ammunition, and then go and deploy to the location, and then drive around and deal with all the breakdowns, and then return early enough in the day to clean your weapon and get all the mud off, and return it. Whereas of course, if you're in a simulation, you can start and you can finish. And then, of course, it is absolutely accurate because no one would ever stick mud on the sensor so that the laser... No. Yeah. But joking aside, there is an awful lot that you cannot do in a simulation, and you have to, absolutely have to have live training. It is, however, 10 times more expensive than CAT, and if you want to have a new vehicle, it'll cost you about £500,000 to stick all these little sensors on it and to model it with the lasers. That's £500,000 and the cost of the vehicle. The Canadians have discovered to their cost that if you just have stick-on stuff that only sticks on the turret, then you're going to get some weird results, because of course, if your turret is looking back and you get shot, then the system goes, oh, that's a frontal attack, because all my sensors are on the turret and none are on the hull. The front of the tank is wherever the turret is pointing. So if you want a new vehicle, £500,000 and a vehicle to use for training. And then, of course, if you want a new training area, you have to have an international treaty with Poland or Kenya or whatever. So, very easy numbers to remember. 25,000, 250,000, 2.5 million. It's 10 times each one. That's assuming that your exercise is Space Invaders on the Rhine heavy metal scenario. If you wanted to do the full panoply of the difficult stuff, contemporary operating environment, UAVs, which we can't fly in the UK without special permission, guys with their legs blown off, pretending to be guys with their legs blown off, Pashto speakers, all of that, then the cost could go up to 7 or 8 million for a live exercise. So we really, really don't want to send someone on a live exercise until he's proven that he knows what he's doing in a simulation. It's a crawl, walk, run paradigm. Very simple, really. You know, if you're going to spend 3 or 4 million on a live exercise when a few guys can mess it up for everyone else, it's essential that you test them on a cheaper system and then you test them at a slightly larger scale on a more expensive system. And then when you do the live exercise, which is absolutely vital to confirm that you've got everything, then you want to make sure they've done it. There's a couple of things about that. Some people don't get computer simulations. They might not be good at them. But of course, being a muscular Christian, they'll head off into the bush with the rain pouring down and they'll show how good they are at live training. Okay, that might be the case. But we live in a much more technological world than we used to. Because that person would say, yeah, we've got this specky geek who's really good at computers. Is he any good out in the field? Well, that's not a problem. We have physical training instructors who've dealt with that difficulty for the last 400 years. If he's a wimp, the PTI is going to get him fit enough, or he's going to be thrown out of the army. But that technological Neanderthal who goes, it's just a computer, I'll be fine when I get in the field, I'm going to be risking 100 times the cost on that guy with no way of evaluating whether he's going to know what he's doing. And I'm going to risk the training for everyone else. So it is actually a problem if you don't get it at the computer basic cheap understanding stage. Okay, air. I don't know that much about air, but I do know we have individual simulators and we have linked simulators. Most of the RAF simulators are high fidelity individual simulators. There is an attempt to link them together, but of course it's very difficult because each aircraft is made by a different manufacturer, each different manufacturer has their own simulator, they're all bespoke, very, very difficult. We do have a system where we have a number of simulators linked together. They're not quite the same high fidelity, but it does allow people to work together collectively. Now, these simulators are not really war games. In theory, they can fly against each other. But 99% of the time, they are used like a role-playing game. You have the pilots who are taking part. The instructors design a scenario. They put a radar here. They put an aggressor pair of aircraft here. They have the terrain and the scenario. And then they fly the pilots along, and they look for specific reactions. They are training these guys to react instinctively in a certain way that gives them an 80% chance of success. Because if they do the drills, they will get an 80% chance of success. And that's what they want to see. So it's a very good and very effective training system. But, as I've said at the bottom, what's missing? We don't really have a constructive force-on-force system. There is Storm, I think, which is like a constructive simulation but against a programmed enemy. It's very difficult to understand exactly how that works, and I've never seen it in 30 years. Maritime is almost exactly the same. The difference is maritime are far more engaged in understanding simulation at the officer level. The RAF, in my opinion, and this is very much flagged up in the limited experience I've had with RAF officers, is they fly simulators, therefore they know what the technology is like. Right. I drive a car. I'm not going to rummage around and fix the electronic ignition. I'm going to get an expert to do that. The Navy is far more willing to get experts together who are in uniform. But essentially, they have the same issue. They have a bridge simulator, and they have ship simulators with the individual stations modelled. And these systems here are very effective. They can be repositioned according to the design of the ship. The screens are touch screens, and they can be reconfigured to match each workstation. So it's extremely good. So they can fight a ship, any design of ship, rearrange the furniture, and work very well. But again, what about a fleet action constructive sim? There might be one. The SDL might have some knowledge. I've just never seen one. Although there's a lot of interest in the Navy about simulation. The reason I say that is I've actually sent someone on one of my courses, whereas we've only recently ever had an RAF person on the course. Okay, other computer war games. We have BC2T at 90 army locations. BC2T is a sort of mini cast intended for the commanding officer to be able to do what you do at cast and to have force on force. It's designed by... It is hideously complicated and has less than 5% usage as it was designed. There's nothing wrong with it. It works fine. If we have people operating it, it's an excellent system. But if we have very busy soldiers who've attended a week's course and have been sent back and been required to do it, it's very difficult. There's two higher level war games, Jocast at JDSCSC and MTWAS at Joint Forces Command. And these are intended to be used as constructive simulations for those headquarters. And then, of course, we have VBS2, the first-person shooter computer game where you have a mission editor and you can make it do what you want. And that's all over the place. Everyone's got that. Lovely. I brought that into the service. Okay, I just leave you with the quote from the China Daily. They see not having combat-experienced officers as a problem, and the way to overcome it is by having adversarial training. All of the systems that I've talked about today were designed with formal military requirements to be able to be used adversarially. It's just we don't choose to do that. Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you.